Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping 7- and 8-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today I'm joined by Michael Tekiu, who is the founder of MomentumShake.com, something I drink every morning. We'll get into what it is, but very cool, interesting product that he's developed. And one of the things from the title, kind of a funky title if it caught your attention, but saving 1 million years of human life is kind of one of the things he's trying to do. It's a health product that focuses on longevity. And I'm certain you haven't heard of anyone talking about like lifespan or longevity recently. This is a brand new topic. Sarcasm dripping from my voice. Definitely something that's gotten a lot of buzz recently, maybe too much. But I love Mike's approach in that he really went out and tried to build something, a product that was best in class with deep conviction. And we talk about that. How do you differentiate your product in one of the most crowded spaces in the world, which is health and supplements and nutrition? We get into that. We talk about his early days when he was couch surfing around and as a music scout and how that kind of influenced his trajectory. He's got some really interesting insights on the 80-20 Pareto's principle, which I'm also sure you've heard a million times, but I loved his take on it, which was unique and made me think differently about it. Talk about advertising as a tax, as an inferior product, and, you know, kind of how to be a great boss and leader. So we cover a bunch of different stuff. Anyway, Mike's a fantastic guy. Love the discussion, and I hope you enjoy it as well. We'll get into it right after this. It is incredibly hard to trust reviews these days. Every restaurant on Yelp is 4.6 out of 5 stars. You get on Twitter and you find out the people promoting and advocating for certain apps end up, you know, actually are investors and they just don't disclose it. It's really hard to know what's real and what's spun. And that's why E-commerce Fuel is so unique and valuable. It's a group of 1,200 vetted 7- and 8-figure owners with zero agenda apart from your success and connecting with one another. No one's pitching you. There's no thinly veiled affiliate links, just operators sharing their unfiltered opinions. Just this morning in our forums, there's a couple of threads that popped up. One about a popular landing page service with 6 members warning people to steer clear. Another member recommending a service, a shipping auditing service that saved them over $200,000 last year. And we take all these reviews over the decade we've been in existence and we compile them into a review directory that has over 20,000 SaaS and agency reviews. So if you want to cut through the spin and the hype and learn from other store owners with zero agenda, check us out. You can learn more and apply at ecommercefuel.com. Did you know that e-commerce stores are losing 10 to 15% of their revenue by not offering upsells? It's true, but you can get that money back instantly with the OneClick Upsell app. OneClick Upsell is already the number one upsell app for over 18,000 Shopify stores, including Tushy, Dr. Squash, Buffy, and Victoria Beckham. And it's made hardworking entrepreneurs like you $670 million in extra upsell revenue. All it takes is a few clicks and you can add pre-purchase, post-purchase upsells, and cross-sells to every product on your store. In fact, the average user boosts their total sales by 10 to 15% as soon as they set it up. It's super easy to get started. Install the app, launch your first upsell funnel, and start making 10 to 50% more sales in less than 10 minutes. So if you like free money, go to oneclickupsell.com after the episode to start your free 30-day trial. Before we get into momentum, your period of couch surfing and like talent scouting for Columbia Records, I thought was super interesting. Maybe for no particular, you know, applicable reason to people listening, but I just think it's a cool little part of your story. So could you talk about that just for a minute in terms of what couch surfing is for people who don't know and what your life was and your job was for Columbia?
Sure. I went to college and wanted to be a singer-songwriter. My dad was a poet for a long time, so it was just something in the family we had. And I figured that the best way to do it was to understand the business side first, because I had spent all of my high school and college trying to learn how to be an artist. So I applied for an internship at Columbia Records right out of college. You still had to be in college, so I went and got a community college credit for it and applied. Then you had to, you know, have enough money to pay for everything, which I did not. So I painted lines in parking lots to make enough money to pay for the plane ticket. And then I was able to sign up for food stamps. And then I couch surfed. So I got out there and I knew nobody. I told everybody at Columbia Records I had a place to stay and, you know, all that stuff. But every 3 days I would move to a new stranger's house. So back in the day, this was before Airbnb, you would just, there was this network of people that would open up their homes, let you sleep on their couch for free. And one day they would stay on somebody's couch. It was kind of a pay it forward. Really beautiful community idea. Like maybe like the internet at its best. Obviously that I don't really think it's a thing anymore. But anyways, every 3 days I would find a new stranger in a new part of New York City. And I would, everything I had lived in a duffel bag. And I think over like a 6 month period, I spent like $500 or $600. And that was the only way to make it work because I was completely unpaid. And it was an amazing experience for me because I got to learn that the business side of music is just insanely hard. Trying to make it in anything is very hard. But also like the corporate world and what I, you know, assumed were like professional adults and what working in an office is like was so underwhelming that I knew I didn't want that kind of cultural thing. And that the thing I was afraid of is like, you know, competing against adults and maybe I wasn't good enough. That image was quickly squandered. Basically, just trying at all was a huge win. Like within like a week, I was put in charge of all the interns and then I was given my own office. And then I was invited to the board meetings to talk about who we'd be signing. That was the first time in history of Columbia Records that an intern never got to do any of that stuff. They didn't find out for like 5 months that I was basically homeless. Every night I would go out and try to find a new band. I'd go to like two or three shows and I'd go, you know, sit in the back and like listen to people. And that was something that really stuck out to me is how many people were trying so hard to make it in art and how few people had the self-awareness that they just didn't have it. The discrepancy between good and great seems like millimeters, but it's obvious. It's a massive chasm. And there's just so little room for anybody not in the great category. And there's just, to the point of noise, the amount of good or like completely terrible people trying to make something. And I think that translates really well to the world of business. If you go on Amazon and you search for any product, there are 300 pages of results. And for the really competitive things, it may be even more than that. I think there are like maybe 3 million sellers on Amazon right now. And the 80-20 rule is really like the 99-1 rule on there. Mm-hmm. 1% of sellers and products are making almost all the money. And so if you're not going to be great, just don't do it. Just like you have to be willing to make whatever you're going to do be great and try harder and sacrifice more.
Did that discourage you as someone who's coming up as, I'm guessing, because you play guitar, right?
Guitar and sing, right, yeah.
Yeah, did that, I mean, after that, did you kind of, if you had dreams, which I'm guessing you did, of being a professional musician, coming into that gig, at the end of that gig, were you like, I'm done? Did it just squash any hope you had of trying to make it?
No, I was totally, I did a very classic thing, which is I thought I was going to be different and special. I got to see hundreds and hundreds of cases of people not succeeding at the thing I wanted to do. And I was like, well, I'm different. I'm special. I'm going to, you know, I just thought I would try and be better. There's just so much competition in that space. So yeah, I went and tried it and I feel like I was good, but I wasn't great. And I at least had the self-awareness after 2 years of really, after New York, I moved to Madison, Wisconsin, which I thought would be a good place to be like incubating as a band, like low cost mm-hmm. of living and lots of college students. We recorded some albums and we tried real hard and I'm happy with the work that we did, but the feedback was clear that nobody cared. I don't take that super personally. I'm really happy that I tried and I wouldn't take any of that back, but trying to sell something that people aren't interested in a super competitive market makes everything else seem so easy. So that's what I got out of that whole experience was like, okay, I can survive in New York on like $100 a month and I can get promoted and put into positions of leadership with nothing, right? So if I can do that, everything else seems super easy. Every business I've ever started since then seems like exponentially easier because I have that baseline for how difficult things are supposed to be. And my expectations are always, hey, you know, you used to be homeless and on food stamps trying to make something work and you were able to do it. You know, now it's way easier. So setting expectations, I think, is vitally important for what we're doing here as entrepreneurs. It's supposed to be hard, or other, everyone would do it, right? It's supposed to be the most complex game that you can play. And I really think that this is like, you know, poker and chess combined, and you're going up against not average people. You're going up against the best people in society who have the most ambition and are most competitive and probably the most intelligent people.
Evil.
Do you know what I mean? Like you're going up against professionals who are obsessed with this stuff. So you have to bring your A game on it. And so that's how I approach stuff, who I'm trying to be when I'm in playing this game.
I've heard a lot of the stories of, hey, the kid moves to New York City to chase his dreams. I don't know if I've heard any quite as scrappy and interesting as the, you know, go tell them I've got a place, totally homeless, you know, crash with strangers for 3 months kind of thing. So you did that. Music in the band didn't work out. You know, you started some e-commerce businesses, sold those. But the one I'm most interested in talking about, random little tidbit, by the way, couchsurfing.com is still online.
Nice.
It's gated. So, I mean, anyone listening, you know, I'm absolving myself of if you get, you know, murdered in the middle of the night sleeping on someone's couch, but it is a really cool community. I've done it for a while. Not a while. I did it a little bit traveling around the US. It's it's a cool concept. But after that, you know, yeah, you went out and started other businesses, had some exits. And what I want to talk to you most about is momentum, because I think that's really interesting. Yeah, repping the brand, beautiful shirt. One of the things I think is most interesting about momentum in your story is that you did something I think a lot of people would love to do, but don't, have been advised not to do in the past, the don't follow your passion thing, which I think has some merits and nuanced discussion. But you built a product you really wanted to see in the world and that you were really excited about. Talk a little bit about the genesis there and like why you wanted to build this, because I think that's a huge part of why it's successful.
Very important self-awareness lesson of where I actually was as a 27-year-old at the end of that journey was that, okay, it's a privilege to do the thing that you're passionate about. Almost nobody gets to do it because you have to be excellent, because everybody wants to do the thing they're passionate about, which is why most people have to do music or art for free, because it's the only way they can even, you know, do it. So to make a living at the thing that you're passionate about is a true privilege that you have to earn, and almost nobody gets to do it. So what I decided to do after that was to remove that from the way I make a living. And so the rules for me were, if I'm going to take something on, it has to be massive. It has to help people in a really tremendous way. And I have to be so naturally excited about it that no one has to force me to do it. I don't have to force myself to do it. And so I just started following my own natural interest as a compass. I discovered that I really like to create things. I really love to learn things. I like to be at the forefront of what, you know, society is working on. And so in 2020, obviously health was a big deal, but also the concept of slowing your aging was just beginning to like take root. And I wanted to create a project that would keep me hyper fascinated and growing for the next decade. And I just found myself spending 5, 6, 7 hours a day like researching science papers and trying to understand biology and sifting through all the nonsense. And then this problem arose that I recognized that there's chaos out there. Everyone has a zillion opinions about what causes aging and what is optimal health. So it's very difficult for the average person to sift through. That there's zero oversight. There's no really, really quality products out there. It's just kind of the Wild West in terms of the supplement. And that it's very difficult and expensive to make a seriously good routine easy for people. So those are the things I wanted to solve, was like, can we make this so simple that it's something you desire to want to do every day instead of a burden? Can we cut the cost by 70% for people? Can I curate all this knowledge into a product that has inherent wisdom in it? You don't have to think about it. You don't have to learn anything. You can just be like, this thing's got it all. And it's every single 9,000 decisions in this has been done for me. And then there's just no work. You don't have to like measure out stuff. So that was it. That's how I got passionate about this and been just so excited about trying to essentially make a masterpiece. I just wanted to see how good can I make something. And I think about Leonardo da Vinci and the Mona Lisa. He spent, I think, the last 16 years of his life painting that single painting.
16 years on that painting?
I 14 or 16, he carried around with him till he died. He was still working on it till his, like his, he died.
Wow. And
he moved everywhere, and that was just something he carried with him, and he worked on it all the time. He was never satisfied with it. And that's what I kind of wanted to dedicate myself to. Like, I'm 4 years into this, and I think it's the best product in the world, but it's not nearly where I want it to be. And I'm just obsessed with, how do I make this better? How do I make this better? How do I make this easier to make so I can make more of it more consistently? So I'm just really obsessed with, this is going to be my masterpiece.
Well, you took what I called the mercenary approach. And I say that with love and affinity, because I took that approach as well early on in my day, selling really boring things purely from a strategic and a analytical kind of filter down view. When you think about the process of building what you're building now, momentum, something you love or passionate about, really interested in, versus back in your mercenary days, for lack of a better term, talk about the contrast in terms of how productive you are, the enjoyment level, how much you enjoy coming to work, how much better do you think the product is? Granted, you know, you were making bath mats. I'm sure you can, well, there's still an art to making anything. Kitchen mats, yeah. So like, I mean, just from an intrinsic perspective and a motivational perspective and a caring about the product and the quality of the product, is it night and day in terms of motivation and kind of the output?
My motivations have changed. Before, it was just hyper-focused on freedom, and financial return is a big part of freedom. So now if you throw more money at me, like, it just doesn't matter. It goes into a bank account. It doesn't check, you know, it doesn't really affect my day-to-day life. So for me, the maximum return is enjoyment of the time that I'm spending. So I don't want to be bored. I don't want to be stressed out. So I kind of design this business around satisfying those needs on a personal level, right? So I get really intrigued about learning more about this stuff. I get really excited about the process every day of like, oh, we just had this breakthrough in manufacturing and we've been able to make this so much faster and more consistent. I just like solving problems. So I really, when you think about first principles, and I'm trying to do life design here, for me, the process became the number one goal. I don't really care about how big or the financial return on the company, like, but is my day-to-day something I get really excited about? Am I happy? Do I feel fulfilled? So I'm trying to maximize the process of doing that. And I think that actually is going to end up with a greater, you know, business and financial return, because this is such a long-term project that I need to make it sustainable for me so I can give maximum effort and insight and passion into what we're building.
Yeah. And so Momentum Shake, I mentioned at the top, you alluded to it as well. It's kind of a once a day longevity, health, pretty much all the basic things you need to be healthy, live longer, feel great. When you think about the research process that went into that, talk a little bit about that. I always think the IP side, the development side, any great product doesn't get launched in, you know, a couple of weeks. It's a pretty involved process. And I think that's a fascinating part of the story, of anyone's story. So talk a little bit about how you developed the formula, what went into it. Health and nutrition is something that, it still shocks me that there's so much controversy over something as basic as what you put in your body, right? Like, it's one of the most fundamental things we have as humans. There's so many opinions about it, so many diets that, you know, and granted, you could say that some have more weight than others from a, you know, a scientific and a data-backed approach. But all that said, it's still complicated. So how did you approach that? Talk about a little bit about that process.
I think incentives are the things that move the world. And so when I was doing all this research, I really wanted to understand a couple things. What are the incentives for the things that are being pushed right now? How can I eliminate negative incentives in the thing I'm trying to build? And really just focus on outcomes for people. So I wanted to make this easy and the highest quality possible thing. Like, those were the rules for me. And I really wanted to lean into the psychology of people. Even the concept of health itself is like, you have to, like, healthy foods taste bad. You have to exercise and it's really hard. Like, everything feels like a sacrifice and like the opposite of what you want to do. Like, why isn't ice cream good for you? Like, why is it only broccoli that's good for you? I hate broccoli, right? Why does exercising got to feel so terrible all the time? Why do I got to convince myself? So I always want to do jujitsu on that stuff. I want to take my natural inclinations and urges and desires and things that feel intuitive and then use that momentum to make them positive habits. So that's why the chocolate shake tastes really great. It's paramountly important. That's why it's simple, because you're not going to do the thing that's helpful for you if you have to force yourself to do it. So part of designing that was coming up with some theories that made intuitive sense to me. And that was, why are we getting older? Aging is a disease. So the aging is a disease that causes almost everything else to happen. They're really just symptoms. If you look at like heart disease or cancer, they're really just symptoms of aging. These things don't really happen in young people. It happens in old people. So your body is not functioning as well, and it introduces the opportunity for all these other things to break down. So if we can solve aging, we can solve tons of other things. So what is aging? And I think it can be really boiled down to something rather simple, and that every day our body gets damaged through the sun, our metabolism, toxins, and every day our body has this magic ability to repair itself. And aging is when the damage is happening faster than the repair can happen. And so when we look at how that's showing up in our body, you can trace every little thing. We lose 50% of our muscle by the time we're 65. We lose 50% of our NAD in our cells by the time we're 60. We lose hyaluronic acid. We lose collagen. All these things are declining as we get older. Those are the raw materials that our body is made out of. It's not pixie dust. It's not a magic molecule that's going to change how you work. It's literally the building blocks of your body, and you lose them and you're not getting enough of them. So can we take those things from the highest quality source, the most bioavailable form at the most effective dose, can we put that all into a shake and make it easy for people? So that was like the main thesis. Like, what are we declining in as we get older? Let's replace it. The other part is, what are most people deficient in their diet? We should be getting as much as we can from, you know, real food, but eating healthy is hard. It takes a lot of effort. We have to be buying incredible ingredients and doing a lot of research when it comes to food. Probably should be cooking a lot. All this stuff makes it really, really hard to do, right? So how can we make that easy and make sure that you're getting the micronutrients that you're most likely deficient in? So that's why we put in the vitamins and the minerals and some of those other things that are required enzymatically to make your body function and use those raw materials, right? So we don't put everything in there, even though it would sell on a marketing thing. You see this big label of stuff, and it's like, we cover all your bases. Well, you're not deficient in vitamin A or C or E, right? Almost nobody in America is deficient in those things. And taking too much of them is bad. So while it would look better for us to put those on the label, we don't include them because you're not deficient in there, and it's going to be negative for you. So we include the things that you're deficient in and not the stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're following, I'm sure you are, Brian Johnson. He's the guy out of California that's pretty much turned himself into a human experimental lab to try to. Mm-hmm. I think his goal is like, don't die, right?
Sure.
Pretty ambitious goal. He gets a lot of hate for what he's doing. People like to tease him a lot. You know, he's just, you know, looks weird, strange. He spends his whole life trying not to die, and he's kind of losing his life in the interim. I'm not sure I would live that way, but I think it's really fascinating what he's doing. And from a scientific perspective, I mean, some of the insights he's coming up with are pretty phenomenal and pretty eye-opening. So anyway, I don't know I'm sure you have followed him a lot, but what have your big learnings been from him, if you have followed him, and thoughts on that process or things that you've learned from him and he's doing that you've maybe even incorporated into Momentum? Because it's pretty wild what he's doing.
I think he is a really earnest, good person. And I think some of the flack he gets is maybe a lack of social grace or intuitiveness about how regular humans work. He's obviously brilliant. And I think he probably suffers from what a lot of brilliant people suffer from, is like just not understanding how humans work. Yeah, eating only between 6 and 10 a.m. and being vegan and, you know, doing this insane, completely unreplicable program is useless, right? Amazing things that have lasted are both effective and beautiful and simple. And what he's doing is none of those things. So I want to make something that's effective, beautiful, and simple. And it is exponentially harder to do, right? I could create a protocol that was 9,000 steps like him, and every single part of it would feel like suffering. you know, which is what he's created. And I'm not saying it's not effective. I'm just saying it's like, what's the point? Because it's no normal person is going to do that, right?
What percentage of the world is going to actually follow in his footsteps?
Yeah, exactly. 0% of those people. You have to have a discipline power that people are genetically given. And maybe he is, you know, maybe people will do that for 30 days and be like, what's the good of living if life isn't good, right? Mm-hmm. So our thesis is, or our mission statement is, to help people live better longer. And it's in that order for a reason. So I think the other thing that he is doing is he's doing 300 protocols, and he's not really scientifically testing which one of these are effective. He's just doing all of them and he's having great results, but I don't think he can actually pinpoint which ones are. So I think he's making some correlative assumptions that mm-hmm. being vegan is the best way to do it. I'm sure if he switched to like a carnivore diet, you know, he would also have great results because he's doing all of these other amazing things. I'm sure that if he stopped the time-restricted eating, he would do all of those other things. I think in life and in entrepreneurship, the 80-20 rule is just wildly important. And when I was younger, I used to think the 80-20 rule was that meant that you only had to do 20% of the stuff and you could be kind of lazy. And what it really means is you need to be doing the 20% of the stuff that is vitally important. You need to be doing that maxed out. The most important things. And he has not distilled what are like the minutiae that may or may not be making a difference and really boiled it down to the most important things in the simplest way that feels better to do it than to not do it. And that takes way more effort. Maybe he'll get there.
Hey, Andrew here, and a quick aside to introduce you to Sam, the owner of ParkerBaby.com, where they sell baby products. Sam's a great guy, a family-focused entrepreneur, has 4 kids, and despite running a very meaningful business, carves out time to spend a ton of time with them. It's a very cool way he runs his life and business. And just a quick little snapshot about his experience with e-commerce Fuel, our private vetted community for 7- and 8-figure store owners.
The first thing that comes to mind, a specific way that ECF has helped my business, my bottom line, was a thread a couple years ago discussing and laying out a plan for reclaiming overpayment on tariffs importing from China to the US. And that thread alone saved me tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7- or 8-figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show.
That's a really good point on the 80-20. I always used to think of it the same way you did. Like, do the 20%, you can kind of, you know, bugger off early and go enjoy cocktail hour, but really means just double, triple, quadruple down on the stuff that works. I like that a lot. I want to talk about your branding. You've got one of the things I think that would be a challenge in the nutritional space. You have so many charlatans in the space. You have so many people selling products. It's impossible for me or an end consumer to gauge the quality of the product because it's a powder, right? And like, it's just, you can't, unless you have your own lab and you're doing the testing on this stuff, it's really difficult, which again, most people aren't going to do. But the things I love, you've done such a good job of branding. I remember opening the box. Boxing is why it's important. I remember, you know, the shaker's well done. The packaging is well done. The book that you have this book that comes with the product. It's like a small little pamphlet, maybe 20 pages, full color. And it shows every ingredient. And the thing that I think you did that was really smart, you talk about why it's included, like why it's important for the body to have this nutrient or whatever it is. And then you also talk about why Momentum is different, like why the stuff you get in Momentum is different from the supplement that you get from somewhere else. Maybe it's, I know you've talked before about like cows in Ireland. You get these special cows that are grass-fed on these amazing hills, and it's just some of the best protein that you can get. Anyway, I just, the efforts you go to explain the why and the sourcing and even just the branding, I think are really well done and they're not wasted. Even going down to the shipping, I know we talked last time about how you do 2-day shipping. And I remember, you know, when you buy something, if it comes a week later, it's kind of nice, but some of your enthusiasm is worn off. But when you buy something, anything really, especially something that, like a supplement or a food product, you want to try it as fast as possible. And so when it shows up 2 days later from an independent company, it's notable. Anyway, you've done a really good job with the branding side of things. It's obviously you've been super intentional there.
Well, thanks. The thing that frightened me about supplements is that I've always associated it with charlatans. I've always associated it with like kind of the Wild West. Cause like, I know like a lot of entrepreneurs in the world and a lot of them, they see gold when they see supplements and they see 90% plus margins, just like zero oversight. And so I didn't want to be associated with that. I always have like these like ick sort of things. And it took me a while to realize that that was an opportunity that I could bring some transparency and some integrity to the space that was sorely missing. Because as a consumer, that's what I felt. When we talk about the 80-20 rule in building a business, I think branding is the first one. And then the second one is the product. And the third thing is the team. And if you can spend, you know, if you can be world class at those three things, you're literally unstoppable, I think. So I put all of my effort into those three things, and branding being the very top thing. And the why that's important is because branding is trying to answer that why question. And it distills into everything else. So for me, the brand, I'm just trying to communicate that we are the Rolex, the Ferrari of supplements, that we are going to be the best at this. And I want you to see that in every single detail. So you know that all the stuff you can't see, we are doing the same way. So you have to, there's emotional, visceral feeling that I'm trying to communicate to create trust that these guys really take this seriously and we're trying to make something amazing here. So that's why I give the same amount of focus on the front end in communicating that. And it's not me saying, hey, trust me, we're the greatest, because those are meaningless words. You have to show it in action, you know, in everything that is thoughtful. So that's why I think branding is so important, because it's an emotional response to subjective things that you're trying to communicate what you stand for, why you're doing it, make sure that your values and principles are communicated in the front and shown in your actions that you are living up to those things. The brand is what kind of is going to determine the quality of the product, the type of team that you build. It's the mission statement. It's all of those things. And it shows up from like the amount of time that you put into like a color scheme or a font, you know, like it that's where people are looking. And I want to show that effort up front. And that's where I think you should be putting most of your time as an entrepreneur, is making sure you have a very clear why, and that why is communicated at every possible step.
Yeah. Talk, if you would, a little bit about your marketing strategy and the economics behind the product. I think those are interesting. Your economics and your margin profile is very different from a lot of other brands, especially in the nutritional space. And then even your marketing, the way you're getting customers is interesting.
My favorite quote is the Jeff Bezos quote about marketing anyways, is that advertising is a tax you pay for an inferior product. So whatever our marketing budget is, I'm always thinking to myself, like, can I take that money and make the product better? Okay, if I can, if there's any room for me to make the product better, I'm going to take whatever I was spending on marketing and make the product better. And then if there's just, I can't find any other way to improve the quality, then the next step is like, can I lower the cost? Can I pass that savings on to people and spend less on marketing? Because every dollar you keep a price down, like your conversions go up, it just becomes easier to sell. So whatever we're doing in business, we're trying to make an offer, right? A super compelling solution to a high demand problem. And then the offer is so good, you'd be stupid not to do it. That's what I'm trying to create. I'm trying to make something easy and obvious for customers. They go there and they see it like, oh, thank God. That's the reaction I want. And that's what we get a lot from people, is like, we get thank you notes all the time in our reviews. Like, I've been taking 20 of these supplements separately. It took, you know, I was spending $500 a month and 30 minutes a day. And now it's a delicious shake. It saves me hundreds of dollars. I feel amazing. I actually follow through on this stuff, because the results are there for people if they follow through. But almost everything in life is we get in our own way and we don't stick with something. So the metrics that I'm measuring success in is like, how many quality years of life can we give to people? And so I'm looking at what are the bottlenecks on that, and price and quality are going to be there, but also just how do I help people create a habit that they want to do? And I've noticed that if I can get people past the 60, 90 day mark, they stick with it. You know, they become lifelong customers because that's enough time to develop a habit, but also see the results. And I think if you did a biological age test, like for me personally, I've dropped my biological age by 10 years. And so if I can do that for 50, 100,000 people, add 5 years of quality life to them, you know, if I could add 1 million years of human potential, that's what gets me really excited. So everything I'm doing is like, how do I increase that number? Where is there resistance, both in human psychology or whatever I can do? I'm going to try to make that happen. And it also happens to be really good business, right? Because acquiring a customer is the most difficult thing to do. So keeping a customer is super important. And then giving them an experience so far beyond their expectations that they feel compelled to share it with other people. And those are the things that you want. And they're both the same answer: make something incredible at an incredible offer.
Yeah. And so is most of your inbound customers right now coming from word of mouth? Is that the biggest driver for you?
I would say over 70% of our sales are just referrals. We do very, very little marketing. I just started to do some very simple ads and testing them out. We've been sold out basically for the last year. And the last month has been me building out a new manufacturing facility. So I can continue, even though prices have gone up on everything over the last few years, I'm trying to make the product better and make it less expensive to create. So we've brought all the manufacturing in-house, and which is, an order of magnitude more complex than most supplement companies are really just media companies. They never see the product. They don't design it. They just put a brand on it. And then they do Facebook marketing. That's all they focus on, is like, how do we sell more of this stuff? And I'm trying to do the exact inverse of that, is like, how little marketing can I do? And how much control can I have? So I think all the innovation and product quality is me being obsessive in the place, making sure it's perfect. So I think the last time we talked, I was just starting to like kick off our new facility, and I've just been living there for basically the last month. And we've gone from making 100 bags a day to 1,200 bags a day. And wow. I think by this time next year, we'll be at like 10,000 bags a day is the goal, I think. So lots of machines trying to figure out how to make those things work really well and consistent, dialing the formula in over and over, and the 500 other things that are required. But that's how we are able to keep adding more and more expensive ingredients and not raising our prices.
Yeah, I remember last time we talked, you were on the early phase of that, or early the front end of that, and were expressed a high degree of surprise at how difficult it was to put together a factory. And from the layman's, the naive perspective, looking from the outside in, you know, it's easy to say, oh, hey, you just get this is just powder. You just get stuff and you mix it together. You put it in a bag. What's the big problem, Michael? Yeah, we don't have to necessarily go into all the weeds on it, but permitting and the types of machines that you get and ventilation, I think, were some of the things that you mentioned last time, were just the tip of the iceberg in terms of things you never even thought about to put together a production facility.
So Elon talks about this. There's a huge difference between making a prototype of something and then making the machine to build that thing at scale, right? Scale is very difficult. Production hell is what he calls it. Every time we do anything, you can't predict all the things that are going to go wrong or be difficult or just problems that arise. And to advance as an entrepreneur, you have to be going through what I call, my personal algorithm is, I call it learn, create, systemize, right? And it's the process I use to turn knowledge into wisdom. So knowledge is like you learning it and then you can actually create the thing. So that was me making, 3 years of research and then putting together the prototype and making the first, couple hundred bags. And then the systemizing part is 10 times more difficult, because you have to not just be able to do it, you have to make it simple and obvious so that the people behind you can do it without thinking. Wisdom is knowledge that's automatic. You've seen this problem, you know the answer, it's already been calibrated, and then hopefully the problem has been removed forever, and it's just like, you hit a button. That's what wisdom to me is the answer without thinking. and hopefully the not even the necessity for the answer. Can you design a system that doesn't, that never sees that problem ever again? So that's what we're trying to build, because I can't live at a factory forever, right? I need to replace myself with competent people, but that they don't have to go in there and solve problems. Systemizing is difficult, and most people skip it. And if you don't systemize, you have a job. You don't have a business. The business is systems. So that is the hyper difficult thing. And I think that what separates an employee from an entrepreneur is the ability to create a simple and beautiful system that anybody can run. And I learned this from the photo booth company that I built. At the time, photo booths took an hour to set up. You had to have a massive van, and it was super complicated. Shit broke on it all the time. So I took it upon myself to design a photo booth that would fit in a Nissan Sentra. You know, a college kid could run it. It would take 3 minutes. Nothing would ever break. It took zero skill set, and it could just be someone who was good with people, and all they had to do was plug it in. So that's what we built. And that's why it turned out to be successful, because we could consistently create amazing experiences, both for the customer and the operator. And that's what I think a factory is. Like, how do we make an amazing product easily without thinking? And that is a really pleasant place for people to work. So like what I had mentioned before, the 20% you really need to focus on is like, you've got to build an amazing team. So a really strong why, but it's got to be an awesome place to work that people who are super talented and, you know, care about what we're doing, want to be there. So how do I create an environment where it's not stressful? It's healthy for them to be there. They want to show up. And so those are the things that I'm trying to learn right now and build. And that's making something simple and easy and beautiful is very hard. And yeah. You can do it, but it'll be stressful. But that last part.
Oh, it's like a factory is the ultimate SOP, right? You're trying to the most complex, highest stakes SOP potentially. How do you, when you think about culture, you talked about creating a workplace that people love to be in. And there's always a tension between, you know, sometimes stuff gets hard, there's deadlines, sometimes you just gotta, you know, bite the bullet and dig in. But from a cultural perspective, how do you do that? How do you, like, what do you, you talk about 80-20, what's the 20% for you of creating an amazing work culture that people want to stick around for 10 to 20 years in?
My big goals this year are to become a great leader and a great boss. And it's something I've never been good at before. Mm-hmm. The lesson that I have been learning over and over again is that most lessons you've already learned, but in different formats. So one of the big breakthroughs in my life was creating an inbound philosophy, was to really pay attention to the feedback that I'm getting and to not move forward on anything on that learn, create, systemize thing. You do that program just over, like, here's your first skill set. You learn how to do it. You create it. You systemize it so you don't have to do it again. And you move up layers. So like leadership is where I'm at right now. And it's the same process. I'm learning how to do it. I'm going to create the team, and then I'm going to systemize so that culture stays the same. But anyways, the inbound philosophy that I have is that the thing has to be easy and obvious, and then you can move on. That's how you know you're moved in the right direction. It just feels effortless. Like, so when you're picking a product, you're not moving forward on launching it or doing anything until you've got like inbound demand. It feels like it's going to be easy to sell. Like you don't even have to ask. You just like, you've created a thing so good with such great product market fit that people are demanding it. They're asking you about it. They're inviting you on to podcasts. You don't have to like do cold outreach. You are solving a supply issue, not a demand issue. And so with the team, I'm creating a product. A job is a product, right? That a team member is buying with their time, right? We're doing an exchange here of value. So how can I make working at Momentum the best possible job offer that you'd be an idiot to turn down, right? So I think that means incredible compensation. I think it means a great work environment, making something that people care about, having a very strong brand with really clear value statement and missions. All those things are important. But the big aha moment for me was that it's inbound. So I'm taking people that reach out to me because they're self-selecting. You know, like, I want to be on the bus. You don't have to commit me. I am loving what you're doing. And then everything is easy and obvious. Like, this is the person that has to be on this team. So it's self-selecting. So it's not like I go find someone that I think is really qualified and I make sure that they're a great cultural fit. Is that like, no, they're a super fan of Momentum. They're into this. And I like working with them. Like, there's no friction. There's, you know, like, they get along with everybody on the team. It's their positive interactions. I don't have to worry about trust or any of those things. So like, it's so obvious. So I'm making sure that the right people are on the bus from the beginning. It's not a series of systems that I'm going to build to like train them and fit them into the mold. Like, they are the right peg to go through the right hole. And it's so obvious. Otherwise, it's just, I'm just saying no a lot to people and very strict about who's going to be in this because the culture is so important.
So you must get a decent amount of inbound interest from people and customers who reach out asking if you're hiring, if they can join the team.
We get a ton of agencies that, you know, cold reach. I'm sure every entrepreneur gets a zillion of those things, right? But in the past, it was always, oh, I need this person. Then I'll just like go put up an ad and see what happens. And now it's, I ask a team member that we have already, like, they've already proven themselves to be like a great fit. And I like, who do you know that you want to work with that's going to fit this culture? And so they're going through a filter already. And the incentive structure I have at Momentum is that people, we are setting goals. And as a team, everyone's going to get rewarded if we hit, you know, revenue goals, right? So when the team members are helping me bring candidates together, they know that we're building the dream team here. And any weak link is going to affect their paycheck. So that's why I think incentives are so strong. Like, we are building something where everybody's going to win if the customer wins. And so it's real selective, I think, as an organism, as a system, that's the thing I'm trying to build as a foundation. So, you know, there are parameters, like, you got to be here at the place. So a lot of our customers per se, you know, don't live in Madison, Wisconsin. So that narrows the field. So that's why I think it's really important to like make sure you get the first person right, and then the next person will come through them, and then them, and then them. And that's how the most successful hires that I've had.
Last question here before we wrap up, Michael. You split time between Madison, Wisconsin, super cool town, and Austin, Texas. I think the good parts of that are obvious, and maybe you can touch on those real briefly. What are some of the downsides about that for having a foot in two different worlds? Because I think that's probably, I think a lot of people dream of that. Or like, hey, I'd love to split time, two places, sounds amazing. But like most things, there are costs to that as well. So what are your favorite parts of the good, but also the downsides people don't think about?
Sure. That's a life design thing, right? Like, and that was freedom of place was the first goal. Whenever I'm thinking about life design, I start with why, right? But then I follow up with why not? So when I'm thinking of where do I want to live, this has got to be one of the top three decisions you have to make in your life, right? Like, what are you going to do? Who are you going to be with? And where are you going to live are going to be the things that affect almost everything else. So that's like 20%, right? Is you want to focus and you want to get that really right. And location matters for both like your own sanity and happiness, but also the social network that you're around. So my why not was, well, where's the perfect place? I have not found a perfect place. Everything has drawbacks and positives. I do not like the winter here in Wisconsin. It makes me sad. So I've always left in the winter. And then I used to just travel all around the world for like 4 or 5 months of the year, right? And I got to go to like 50 something countries. I've probably spent 5-6 years abroad cumulatively. And I learned so much. The downside to that is that you don't develop a community, right? You're always just wandering. And I think community is just insanely important for happiness. It's insanely important for growth. So when I picked Austin is to be like a winter place, I wanted to make sure that I was going to be around entrepreneurs that inspired me, that held me to a higher standard, gave me something to work towards. That just really, I think that's the place right now for, unless you're in tech, maybe it's San Francisco, but if you are doing what we do, and I think Austin's the place to be. Horrible summers. Just don't want to do it. It'll make me sad. So I have created a lifestyle that I thought was the best for me. And I'm here in the woods in Wisconsin. I got 22 acres surrounded by like 500 acres of nature preserve. It's really peaceful for me out here. I love, you know, I got really long-term relationships here that are important to me. And in Austin, it's like the total opposite. I live in a condo near downtown. And I'm just super social and I just get to meet incredible people all the time. The networking is just so powerful to be around people that you're inspired by. Downsides are that you have to put a lot of effort into maintaining relationships in both places. You have to have a partner that is going to have created the same sort of freedom of place that you have, or you have to be willing to support that person. And they have to have the community in both places to be happy. And that's something that I'm working on still. And then the other downside is cost, right? But there are solutions to everything. If you're a creative, when it came to cost, I just figured out that I could rent out my furnished places when I needed the money, you know, like, so I would just do the opposite and rent it out. And so it actually turned out where I was making money having a two home lifestyle because I could rent it out for more than it costs. Downsides are you have to be a landlord. Now I don't rent it out because I don't have to, like money's superfluous for me. Now I just have two places to manage, right? So that makes that you have like a slight headache in that sense, like a lot of air conditioners that go can break, things like that. So just trying to systemize those things to be as simple as possible to remove that downside. Yeah, I just get to a place. I used to be insanely cheap, like detrimentally, like obsessed with not losing or spending money. And that was from being broke for so many years, right? Literally living on food stamps. And it's taken a lot of like untraining to be looser with money. And I flipped my psychology on like, I can save a lot of money and put all the effort into trying to save money. Now it's like, okay, well, what do I need to do to just make that extra money? Not even have to think about it. So it's easy. And once you learn how to make money, adding, you know, you just, okay, I need $100,000. Okay. And you just come up with something and you've figured out how to make more money. It's way easier than trying to save money or stress about it and trade your time and effort.
Yeah. I heard someone say something along the lines once of, you don't have to save your money in the same place. You know, if like, if, for example, if you want to leave a place unrented because it's very, very convenient, you don't necessarily have to do, you know, you don't have to, if you have a piece of real estate, you don't have to rent it out to cover the mortgage. You could, if it's easier for you to make that money in a business or something else, do it that way, you know? And but sometimes our minds don't think like that. It's just strange.
Yeah, it's really hard, particularly with business, right? I always think about that. Like you don't have to make the money back the same way you lost it.
Yes.
So like holding on to a stock that's a loser because like it's got to come back, like just sell it, put it into another stock or like a business. I've held on to businesses that were never going to work for a really long time because I wanted to pay them back. But like literally every minute I spent on this loser meant I wasn't spending it on like a winner like Momentum, which would have had an exponential return for the effort. So really cutting losses as soon as it becomes apparent that this will not be easy and obvious and just move it on to something else. And you could probably do that with people on your team, relationships. I've never cut something too early and regretted it. It's always I've hung on to a thing or a person way, way past its expiration date, trying to make something work that wasn't easy and obvious.
Yeah. Michael, appreciate you coming on, especially given the fact this is, again, the second time you're doing this. You're a patient and forgiving man. If you haven't checked it out, momentumshake.com. I drink it every day. It's delicious. It's amazing. Strongly recommend it. So, you know, like Michael said, it's just a combination of 20 super high quality. And we didn't get into the ingredient selection, but you're very intentional about sourcing insanely high quality ingredients for this. And you talk about it throughout the literature in your product. But momentumshake.com user, love it. Strongly recommend. And anything else you want to add, Michael, before we kind of wrap this up?
If anybody wants any kind of help, you can reach me at mike@momentumshake.com. If I can answer your question, you know, pretty quickly, I'm really happy to do that. I love helping people as much as possible. That's my motivation today is like, I hope this was valuable and wisdom is the goal. And hopefully you can learn it from other people's mistakes. Hopefully I can transfer some of that and make your job just a little bit easier. So yeah, if you have a direct question, just shoot me at mike@momentumshake.com and I can try to answer you real quick.
Awesome. Yeah, I loved your thought, wisdom is knowledge that's automatic. That's a really interesting way. That's just so ingrained in you that you don't have to think about it. It's just is there immediately. I love that kind of framework. So Mike, thanks so much. This was a blast. And yeah, man, looking forward to seeing you next time in person or tomorrow morning in my little shaker one way or another.
Andrew, thanks. True pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week. A big thank you to OneClick Upsell, who offers incredible upsell software to get more from every single customer and increase your average order value on your site. To make more money from the customers you already have, check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And if you own a 7 or 8 figure store, you really should be a part of our private community and forums here at Ecommerce Fuel, where you can connect with over 1,200 store owners just like you. We're so confident it'll be a game changer that we offer a 10x ROI guarantee. If you don't see 10x your membership value in the first year, we'll refund you 100% of your membership fees plus toss in an extra $1,000 for the hassle. So you can learn more and apply at ecommercefuel.com. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and look forward to seeing you again next Friday.